So tonight, it's kind of an interesting topic. The problem with too much self-control. And it's a paradox in many ways, because, of course, probably your first thought is, well, isn't self-control a good thing? And of course it's a good thing. You know, people who have zero self-control have all kinds of problems in life. Many of them wind up in prison. And if you think about the life that Buddhism asks us to live, living according to the Eightfold Noble Path and a life of mindfulness and patience and all these qualities, it takes tremendous self-discipline to live up to these ideals. So I think I would say that we're going to go out on a limb and guess that people who have their act together enough to make it to a Monday night meditation group, people who find it, you know, rewarding to do something like sit 40 minutes in quiet, we're probably at the upper end of, on the spectrum of self-control. Probably self-control is something that's come relatively easy to us in many areas of life. Not necessarily every area. And certainly all of us probably have ways that we could grow and sort of refine our self-control in you know, this area or that area. Now, it's very funny. The people who have little or no self-control, and self-control really, it's not a single skill. It's actually, you might say, a suite of skills. You know, impulse control and delayed gratification and, you know, thinking before you speak, thinking before you act, anticipating consequences, all these sorts of things. People for whom all of those skills are very challenging, the reason they're challenging is because in early childhood, those skills weren't modeled for them. They were not rewarded for those skills. Maybe they grew up in a very haphazard or chaotic kind of place. And so they never had a way to integrate that. And that sets them up for all kinds of challenges later in life. It's very sad. Conversely, those of us for whom self-control came relatively easily, that's also because of early childhood stuff, you know, ways that it was modeled for us. And there's also ways that the kind of parenting that produces kids who are very good at self-control, they might also be producing kids that are maybe a little more on the obedient or compliant side, perhaps kids who are even a little bit over-controlled or over-self-regulating. I think this is something that might be a little more common among people who tend to go to meditation sanghas and do spiritual practice and this sort of thing. And it would be a characteristic of, some of the characteristics of having too much self-control or being too over-regulated. It might be things, for example, feeling like one is a spectator to life rather than participating, or feeling that there's a kind of fun that other people are having and somehow one is not able to participate in that fun, sort of envying the freedom of others in some way. As, you know, why do other people get to have the freedom to, you know, be alive and open in the way they are, and I'm not able to do that, that sort of thing. And so what is going on, and what's the difference between healthy self-control, and certainly a lot of self-control is perfectly healthy and life-affirming, and sort of unhealthy self-overregulation? I've been thinking about this question for a couple of weeks. It's a fascinating question. So this is the point in the Dharma talk where we're going to take a bit of a Jungian turn. Jung talked a lot about how ego is only a small part of the psyche as a whole. It's an influential part, Certainly the things that ego does and the things that ego thinks and decisions it makes can have psyche-wide implications. The ego can be a kind of bully in the psyche in some ways. But there's much of the psyche that is beyond the ego. And Jung talked about these things, you know, like the shadow and the anima or animus, these regions of the psyche that are just energies that are beyond ego energy. Ultimately, all the archetypes are beyond ego energy. And one thing that he emphasized in many ways is that the rest of the psyche has a kind of energy of otherness compared to ego. And a great example of this, actually, it's this kind of funny story I heard at one point from Robert Bosnak, who's a Jungian author and lecturer. I was attending a lecture of his, and he was talking about this issue of the otherness of the psyche. And he talked about a dream that he had. And it was, he said this was the only time in his life that he's ever had a lucid dream. A lucid dream is when you're dreaming, but you're aware inside the dream that this is a dream. I've never had a lucid dream myself, but I've read a lot about it. And so he said that he was in some sort of city with his son, and I don't know what else they were doing, but at one point they pushed a statue into a river or something like this, and he said the moment the statue hit the water, suddenly the dream became lucid. And he's kind of looking around at this whole world like, wow, this is my dream. I'm dreaming this, you know? And he's sort of fascinated with the whole experience. And right then a cab pulls up, and he walks over to the cabbie all excited and saying, you know, this is my dream. You know, I've created you and your cab. You know, this is all my dream. The cabbie looks at him and says, buddy, you're crazy, and just drives off. And what I love about that is it just shows sort of the almost, you might say, the rugged otherness of the psyche, of the parts of the psyche that are outside of ego. And so one way to think about this, think about the beings that in traditional societies were called gods. Think about Greek gods, for example. And there's lots of ways to think about gods, but one way to think about it is that ancient people had some intuition that there are times that I'm acting and it's me, and there are other times when there's an energy moving through me, and it's not actually me, so I'm going to call that energy a god. And so there were various, you know, gods of war, god of love, you know, all these sorts of things. So, for example, Ares or Mars is a god of war. Well, war, of course, is a very heavy term, but we could just say anger. Certainly Mars was a god of anger. Anger, for example, is a powerful energy. And it's an energy that has, as it were, a life of its own. It's not that I decide, I'm going to be angry now. It's something that happens to me. It's an energy that visits me from outside. You can imagine, a person that's very calm, a nice, you know, polite, overregulated person who's always on an even keel. And then at some point, something flips their lid and they're screaming bloody murder one day. And you'd see them and you'd say, oh, wow, that he really wasn't himself at that moment. You know, and there's profound truth in that. There's another energy acting, and it's not his ego that's acting at that moment. Anger is another energy. It has the energy of otherness. Really, all the strong emotions, sadness, fear, anxiety, none of these are emotions that we decide, okay, I'm going to experience this now. They're emotions that visit us. They take us over. Much in the same way with many of the positive emotions. Of course, we usually don't complain about joy. If joy, you know, takes us over, we have no problem with that. You know, certainly Aphrodite is a goddess of love and sexuality, all that. None of that we choose. I don't choose to be attracted. I don't choose to fall in love. I probably don't object if it happens, you know, but... all of these are energies that overtake us. And so the question becomes, if we think of this, of the whole of the psyche as you might say, a kind of village or a kind of neighborhood with these various others, and ego is one among many, what relationship does ego have? Is ego a good neighbor? You know? Now, imagine somebody came into this sangha and started saying things to somebody else like, you can't talk at all, you're always wrong, don't even open your mouth, I don't want to hear another word from you. Like, that would be beyond rude if someone were actually treating another person like that. But there's ways that we treat parts of ourselves like that, you know? And you can imagine, suppose someone were treating you like that for years, you would not be happy about it. And if finally they wanted to start a conversation with you, you'd have a long list of grievances. Like, that's where the conversation would start, you know? And so that's often what happens with inner work. When we start to listen to ourselves, we start getting this long list of grievances. Well, why were you yelling at me for all these years? You know, that sort of thing. The writer David Rico is a wonderful writer, and he talks about the five A's that he views as the key to any relationship. The five A's are attention, affection, acceptance, appreciation, and allowing. And he says that any healthy friendship, any healthy love relationship would have all five of these. And so certainly it's wonderful to consider, you know, are these things that you're giving in your relationships? Are these things that you're receiving in your relationships? You know, all good questions. But they're also good questions to bring into the inner conversation. In relating to my anger, am I giving it attention? Am I giving it acceptance? Am I giving it appreciation for the wisdom that it has? Anger has a lot of wisdom in it, a lot of vitality in it, you know? Am I appreciating that? Am I allowing it to be what it is? You know, am I allowing my vital energies to have a life of their own? And the funny thing is that ego will have this story. Well, if I let all of them have a life of their own, then I'd run wild, you know, that sort of thing. Ego loves to do this, like, if it's stuck on one side and entrenched in one side, it likes to paint, like, any move to the other side as being a total apocalypse, you know? Ego is just a riot that way. In fact, the truth is something very different. And this is a complex idea, but think about the interpersonal world is such a powerful metaphor, actually, for the intrapersonal world in this regard. If I'm living my life with integrity and doing the thing that I ought to do, and then each other person is doing the same, now, I might not understand what somebody else is doing, they might not understand what I'm doing, you know. In fact, there might be moments when it even looks like we're working at cross purposes, but I would trust that if we're all working with integrity, that there's kind of this sort of magic that there'll be this greater synergy and the greater work that needs to happen will happen. And much in the same way, there's this profound wholeness to the whole of the psyche. And so if I'm letting the anger do what it needs to do and the depression do what it needs to do and etc., I need to trust that ultimately it will all be for the good of the whole. It might not be what ego wants at the moment. You know, it may well involve changes, you know, even changes in who ego thinks it is to allow that kind of energy. And yet, trusting, how can I say, wholeness and healing are really our fundamental nature. Like, healing is, at a very fundamental level, something we simply need to allow to happen. It's not something we need to work for or achieve. Healing is something that enters our life much more through the movement of surrender rather than, you know, intentional effort. So at this point, I'm going to read a poem by Rumi. And I'll just say this entire topic is one that Rumi just loves. He has so much to say on this topic. So this poem, you may be familiar with it. It's called The Guest House. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if there are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. So I'll pass out the quote sheet, which has that poem.
I was afraid you weren't going to have a quote sheet.
What's that?
I was afraid you weren't going to have
a
quote sheet.
Oh, my. Oh, you always get a quote sheet.
Yes, please.
It's amazing the expectations I've created. So we have the poem by Rumi. You have David Rico's 5 A's. And incidentally, if you're interested in his book, that's the book. Entitled How to Be an Adult, which I highly recommend. From the Stoic philosopher Epictetus, freedom is the only worthy goal in life. It is won by disregarding things that lie beyond our control. And of course, it's things that lie beyond our external control as well as lie beyond our internal control. Another quote by Rumi, be passionate for the friend's tyranny, not his tenderness, so that the arrogant beauty in you can become a lover that weeps. This great one from George Bernard Shaw, to be in hell is to drift, to be in heaven is to steer. And it's a great one, but it also speaks very much to the ego's desire to just be in control of everything. From Ralph Ellison, from that classic Invisible Man, life is to be lived, not controlled, and humanity is won by continuing to play in face of certain defeat. It's a very humbling one. From another book by David Rico, humility means accepting reality with no attempt to outsmart it. From Terence McKenna, the great intellectual of psychedelics. Chaos is what we've lost touch with. This is why we've given it a bad name. It is feared by the dominant archetype of our world, which is ego, which clinches because its existence is defined in terms of control. Wow. From that wise woman, Bell Hooks. The practice of love offers no place of safety. We risk loss, hurt, pain, we risk being acted upon by forces outside our control. So true. From Patrick Ness, it's not that you should never love something so much that you can control it. It's that you need to love something so much that you can never be controlled. It's not a weakness, it's your best strength. This great one from Paula Hawkins. I've lost control over everything, even the places in my head. Fascinating one from Ray Carson. Sometimes it's best to let your opponent think he has control. From Steve Maraboli. You must learn to let go, release the stress. You were never in control anyway. And then four from this pair, I discovered this pair this week and I was very impressed with them, Mark and Angel Chernoff. So four quotes. One is, it's not what you say to everyone else that determines your life. It's what you whisper to yourself that has the greatest power. Damn. The second one, one of the most rewarding and important moments in life is the moment you finally find the courage to let go of what you can't change, including what you can't change about yourself. The third one, when you hear only what you want to hear, you're not really listening. Listen to what you don't want to hear. That's how you grow. And again, that listening to what you don't want to hear is also both external and internal. Putting in extra love and effort, doing the hard things, is always worth it, because those are the things that ultimately define you.